Now, you're very welcome back to the programme. We've just been giving a gift. It's fantastic. We'll talk about that more in a moment. We were speaking about the, if you want to go and get your blood pressure checked at Letterkenny Shopping Centre, it's running between 11 and 2. So it's just got on the way and it's there till 2 p.m. So Nurse Cathy's down there. So if you're in the shopping centre or you want to bring himself or herself and sneak the blood pressure check on them, then you can get down there up until 2 p.m. A caller says, I've been on sleeping tablets, anxiety tablets and antidepressants. It's not under review. I think it's strange that they aren't being checked. 30 tablets a month in sleeping ones alone. Well, I'd suggest to go back to your GP and say, look, I'm on a lot of tablets here and I wouldn't mind what, you know, can we talk about maybe coming off them to some extent? Hi, I was trying to ring my GP since 10 past nine this morning because I have a chest infection. I got through at 10:35. The receptionist told me, sorry, we're fully booked, ring tomorrow morning. So what do I do now? Just because the doctor is busy, I have to suffer with a chest infection. These doctors are a joke, believes this listener. And then these receptionists think they are doctors. Well, in fairness to the receptionists now, they are there to answer the phone and pass on the messages, I suppose. Right, okay. Now, we are joined in studio by Anne Scott, who's the club president of Inishowen Rugby Club. Good morning to you, Anne.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Not too bad at all. Right, 50 years the club's been in existence now.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. It started off around the early 70s and there were three local men who had the vision. They were keen rugby players themselves. Noel Hunter, who's no longer with us, he had come to live. He married an Inishowen lady, came to work there and he'd played rugby for Connacht. And Jim McCarroll, who was one of the local vets, he'd played rugby at school. And then my late brother-in-law, Robert Scott, he was a keen rugby man too. So the three of them got together and decided that Carndona, the Inishowen Peninsula, could do with a rugby team. And it all developed from there.
And of course, it is Inishowen Rugby Club now. At the time of its launch, was it Carndona focused or was it always a peninsula-wide rugby club?
Well, I suppose it started off in Carndona. I wasn't here then, but it does now take in the whole peninsula. The town itself, Carn, isn't big enough to really support one.
No, of
so
course,
we take players from the whole peninsula and it's great.
Yeah, okay. And what kind of facilities do you have there now? I suppose there's been a lot over the years, efforts and ongoing efforts.
Yeah, for many years the club has played down the Moss Road and many people who have played there will remember nearly drowning in the muck down the Moss Road. It's a good field. And in 2013, five trustees met the local, the Donegal County Council, and we bought the almost 9 acres there to provide three pitches for the rugby club. And because of that, we're in a position to get funding through Sports Capital. And since we opened the pitches, we levelled them and revamped them in 2017. And since COVID, during COVID, we've really built the present changing rooms, which are going to be officially opened this Saturday coming.
Yep, and we'll talk more about that because it's a sort of event, isn't it? Mm. It's marking the half century, but it's also celebrating the opening, official opening of these facilities. And is it difficult to maintain a rugby club in this part of the world? I mean, rugby is hugely popular. Is it as popular in Donegal as it might be, saying Sligo, Mayo, Galway? Because there's so many other sports to compete with, of course, and compete with not only for the talent but the eyes.
Oh, of course. I mean, the Irish rugby team has done exceptionally well this year, and the professional sport is watched by so many people. Ulster are doing pretty well this minute as well. And that obviously filters down. And our own local team has done very well. They two Saturdays ago, they won the Provincial Northwest League. And that was a huge achievement for our lads. It's rugby is growing. And it's when the club started in the early 70s, rugby was for the big boys, the big hairy men of all shapes and sizes. But then mini rugby was introduced. And then one former teacher in Carndona Community School, PJ McGarry, introduced rugby to the community school. And that was a huge boost because we used to depend, the club used to depend on new guards, new doctors,
new vets,
teachers coming in, and the average age of the team got 1 year older every year. But once the rugby came into the schools, then you started to get cohorts coming through each year.
Yeah.
And there are certainly three people greatly involved with it, four greatly involved with the club at the minute, who were all in the same year. Liam Crampsey, Brian Keogh, Brian McNally, Alison McLaughlin. And they have been a huge asset to our club in recent years. You know, they're bringing new players in.
On the national scene, it really is quite remarkable, isn't it, when you think of the size of this country, that we are, you know, the best, one of the best teams in the world. It really is unbelievable. What is that down to, do you think?
Passion, I think, and Ireland loves its sport.
Yeah.
You know, no matter whether it's boxing, Gaelic, rugby, rowing, you know, so many athletics, gymnastics. There's so many sports that have really taken people's interest and caught their interest. But rugby is, at our level, at grassroots level, it is a sport for all shapes and sizes. And we, our coaches at underage level have been fantastic. No player is left on the side. If you're going to a game, everybody gets to play. The result really doesn't matter. You know, and as I said, at mini level, the referees all seem to have Alzheimer's because it's always a draw. You know, the youngsters are so competitive, but it's important to get everybody involved. And it's a very much a team effort. It's, you can have very good players, but unless the forwards win the ball, the backs can't score. So it is a team effort, and that's where everybody has to be involved. So whilst you may not actually kick the penalties or score the tries, but if you can win a ball in a ruck so that it goes out to the backs, then you've done your job. It has to be a team effort, and that's where it's so good. And the girls are getting so involved in it now. There's actually one of our under-18s players, she's going up on a training session with the Ulster set up, Erin McConnellogue, this evening. So we wish her all the best.
I think just there's some moves in terms of, you know, professionalising the sport, if they'll take up the contracts, if they're attractive enough. But we've, judging by some recent results, we've got a lot of work to do with our women's team. So the more talent we have coming through, the better. So it's been about, the last 50 years has been about milestones and firsts and what have you. And that's what's happening this coming Saturday as well. It's the first time a interprovincial fixture has ever taken place in Donegal, or it's the first Donegal club to ever host one.
As far as we know, yeah.
And we're going to keep saying that until such time as someone says otherwise.
Exactly. As far as I know, it is. And this is, people may be a little bit confused. It's a junior interprovincial.
It's an interprovincial.
It's still an interprovincial. Oh, absolutely. It's a huge coup for us. And there have been quite a few people in the Ulster branch who have supported us greatly in securing this for us. We are a small club. There's no doubt about it. But the one thing that people, you talk to people throughout the whole province of Ulster, and what they remember about Inishowen Rugby Club are the hard-fought matches and the hospitality afterwards. And we are well known for that. And our own John Merritt is probably, comes to the fore in that, you know, teams are looked after and they do enjoy coming to Inishowen, even if they think that it's so far away. That's our problem.
Well, that's always the challenge, isn't it? Right, so it sounds to me like it's going to be a fun day in that there's the doors open, gates open at 1:30, there's some pre-match entertainment, then the match itself starts at 2:30, that's kickoff. Under-16s are for free and entrance is €5 per adult. So even if you've maybe you've watched it on the telly but never gone to see a high-level game, up close and personal, why not?
Yeah, it's... there is nothing quite like watching a grass, well, it's not a grassroots, but watching a live match close up.
You hear the grunts and the bangs and the knocks. And
you
the,
do. Yeah. And, you know, when the ref says engage and you hear the two scrums, two, each pack of forwards coming together, there is something about that. And the smell of mud, although the hopefully it'll be a dry day and the pitch is looking fantastic. Our groundsmen have done a great job.
Well, they have
job.
To, I think, you know, I mean, any field sport, the pitches and all, can cut up quite badly. But I'd say it's particularly challenging to keep the surface to a high level with rugby, especially given our climate, you know, and it has to be a grass and a soil that can take a scrum or two.
Well, we're so lucky because the grounds at the Moss Road are gravel based, and we have treated them and we're looking after them as best we can, you know, but it is an ongoing problem.
Yeah, it's a challenge for sure. It's all part of it. Right, okay, so it's at the Moss Road in Carndonagh. It's this Saturday, the 6th of May. It is 6th of May, this coming Saturday, isn't it?
Yeah.
Gates open at 1:30, pre-match entertainment from 1:30pm, kickoff at 2:30. Entrance is €5, under 16s are free. So what is for the likes of the Innishowen Rugby Club in the league setup? So with whom do they play their matches?
Well, previously we would have played the Northwest Regional.
Okay.
And that would really have been clubs, other clubs within Donegal.
So like Donegal Town Rugby
Donegal
Club.
Donegal Town, Letterkenny. Yeah. There's Finn Valley. Well, they would mostly just youth. Strabane, Derry. Those local ones, to really to cut down the amount of travelling.
Yeah, of course.
But we had we were playing in a cup final or a shield final, and we had to travel to Newtownard. You know, that is quite a distance.
Yeah.
But that's the problem, and our boys are used to travelling. It's harder to get teams from the east of the province to come up here.
Of course.
But in fairness, they're getting better, and as I said, they do usually enjoy it. So. Our first have moved up to the provincial Northwest, so they were having to travel to places like Coleraine, Ballymena. So that takes in those clubs as well.
All right, good stuff. Don't forget the under 14 girls are in Malone on Sunday in the Ulster finals. How could you forget? I know you were just about to say that before I said it.
Yeah, it's hard to keep track of everything, but
well, try harder, Anna.
Oh, yeah, try harder. Forgive me, girls. But Oliver and Tara McConnell have done a fantastic job in bringing on the girls' section, and they really are loving it.
Yeah.
And the girls are so dedicated, and they really put their heart and soul into everything, and they're really enjoying it, which is part and parcel.
That's what it's all about, isn't it? It's great for them, and it's great for the area, and it's a different, it's an alternative, because you know, not everyone likes the same thing, so it's another opportunity for people to compete and what have you. All right, so 50 seasons, it's an amazing achievement, and to be able to make that progress too over the last six odd years in terms of getting new purchasing the land and getting the changing rooms fixed. So the Ulster versus Munster junior men's interprovincial match and official changing room opening, it's this Saturday, the 6th of May 2023, of course, and it's at the IRFC Moss Road, Carndonagh. And you can go along from 1:30, that's when the gates open, kick off at 2:30, some entertainment beforehand. Is it you juggling or what is it?
We have the support we've had from the local community has been absolutely wonderful, so there will be some music and
brilliant.
The brass band's playing and there'll be a few other things and refreshments too.
It's a nice time of the day too, something to do in the afternoon, and then you have your evening to yourself. All right, listen, lovely of you to call down to us, Anne. Continued success. Here's to another 50 years. And I'm sure, I hope Saturday's well attended. I'm sure it will be well attended.
We just pray for a dry day.
And it'll be well, I can't guarantee that. But we can certainly guarantee enthusiastic teams competing. All right, Anne Scott, club president of the Innishowen Rugby Club. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
How's your Tuesday going? Don't forget, get in touch with us. 086 60 25,000. That's the WhatsApp and text, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. A further reminder for you, by the way, if you you're unavailable to listen between 9 and 10 or 10 and 11 or whatever it might be, that you can always podcast the show. It's available for you, broken down into the 3 hours on our website, highlandradio.com, in the playback section. Catch up, I can't remember what it's called. But anyway, it is there for you to listen when you want to. Or you can re-watch the show as well by going on to YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, or across our Facebook pages. And of course, today is, and I can't remember the exact name of it, what the actual day's called, but it's to raise awareness for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. And the reason we initially started, or I wanted to initially start streaming the show on the internet so you could watch was also because it comes with subtitles. So if you've got someone in your life or your house that's hard of hearing and they want to keep up with what's happening, you can put us on YouTube on your Fire Stick or your smart TV and switch on the captions. They're not perfect, but they're not far off it either, and they can keep a track of what's happening across the northwest, the country and beyond, by way of reading the subtitles. So I do know many of you avail of that, and for those of you who weren't aware, that's one of the services we provide here. Right, the Minister of State for the Office of Public Works, Patrick O'Donovan, is on the programme now. Good morning to you, Minister. Thanks for taking the call today.
Yeah, good morning, and good morning to your listeners as well.
Right, we're speaking to you to help let people know about new flood relief schemes being announced for Donegal Town and Letterkenny. What's happening?
Yeah, well, I actually am here in the Glebe House at the moment where we just opened an outdoor classroom. But earlier this morning, I was in with the officials of Donegal County Council and some of the elected members of the council as well from the Letterkenny and Donegal Municipal District. The last time that I had been here as Minister of the Office of Public Works, I basically had very good discussions with the council. And I said it this morning in front of the elected members that, you know, I would rate Donegal County Council really highly in terms of the work that they're trying to do from a climate adaptation point of view. And I put out a call to them that if there were additional resources made available to the Office of Public Works in terms of personnel that we would pay for on top of the people that we're already paying for within the council, would it help advance the development of a scheme for both Donegal Town and Letterkenny? So over the last couple of months, through a business case appraisal and everything else, we've been working with the council, and I'm glad to be able to provide the announcement that we have approved additional resources to the Donegal County Council, bringing the total up to 5, that will allow now for the early preliminary work around data collection for Donegal Town and Letterkenny to be able to be started, which is vital in terms of a planning process, that we collect all of the preliminary data around the tides, around the river basin, around catchment flows, around all of the existing risks that are there to the two towns from water, many of which the listeners in your programme will be only too acutely aware of when they see thousands of tonnes of excrement and sewerage and everything else flowing through their front doors. But we have to start the preliminary work. We have to collect the data, and basically it is the start of a process that we hope will lead fairly soon to the development of a scheme that we can submit for planning permission through Donegal County Council. So it's very positive for both towns.
What is new about this delivery model? Like, what are we doing or piloting here that it hasn't been done heretofore?
Well, what we're doing is we're doing a joint venture between ourselves and Donegal County Council and ourselves and Kilkenny County Council. So one, a coastal county with huge obvious risks from the Atlantic, and the other, a landlocked county with risks from an estuary, but as well as that from risk from flashy catchment. So we realise in terms of the pace of climate change that you know, the speed at which our climate is changing is far more pronounced than it was than we had at the original design of our flood relief schemes under what's called CFREM. So we're basically, for want of a better word, we're putting a greater level of onus of responsibility on local authorities to do an awful lot of the preliminary work that either we would do or that we would get external help in to do. But to do that, we need an extra complement of civil engineers and other technical experts. In many cases, these are the young people themselves with career opportunities to come into the likes of Donegal County Council, and we'll pay for it, that will help in the development of a scheme that will ultimately lead to planning permission. Now, we've done stuff like this similarly before, where we pay for staff within the local authorities. They do work on our behalf, and it leads to the development of a planning application. I think this is different in terms of the scale. These are two huge towns. They're strategically important, both in terms of the county, but as well as that in terms of the region's significance for the government. These are areas of strong population growth. They're also areas that are particularly vulnerable, one from Lough Swilly, the other directly from the Atlantic. And when you get saddened land with the prevailing winds from the southwest, in the case of Donegal Town, or from the north and northeast for Letterkenny, it can cause devastating consequences. Mm-hmm. And we're only too acutely aware of that. However, taking all of that into account, we also have to adhere to planning processes. We have to have detailed public consultation and engagement, and that will start and commence as part of this. Because if we don't do that, what happens is invariably we got objected to, and these objections can sometimes wind up in court, and they can add years to the development of a scheme. So We have a very, very good relationship with Donegal County Council. They have delivered a lot of work for us in terms of minor schemes, which in many cases would be one-staff houses out the country where we provide the money for the council to divert water away from houses, groups of houses and things like that, has been quite successful. And then in the other schemes around the county as well that are more susceptible to flooding, we're also paying for the development of those, leading to planning applications and their construction.
So I presume then what this allows is there's going to be mitigating work that's ongoing, but we also need to presumably plan for what mitigation is required for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years' time. Is that part of this? So in other words, this flood mitigation work is future-proofed?
All of the work that we're doing is future-proofed, and as we look at sea level rises and if we look at rainfall patterns over maybe a 40, 50-year period, and we're conscious of that because the rate of change over the last century would have been fairly stable, but the rate of change in the previous 20, 30 years has been like a rocket. So we know that we have to future-proof, and this is where the difficulty arises for communities. You know, we have to protect the houses, property, first and foremost, life, and that does involve significant infrastructural development on the banks of our rivers, inside in the hearts of our towns. And while some people mightn't like it, the reality is we have to do it in order to protect these places for the future so that we can sustain communities into the future. Because in the absence of the engineered solutions that we're talking about, a lot of these places won't have a future. And that is the reality. And in fairness, across politics, we get a lot of support from people who are anxious to see works that we have completed in other parts of the country, whether it's, you know, in relation to Waterford, Cork, Tipperary, wherever it is, that is replicated in areas that are particularly vulnerable from the sea. And we are at the moment completing a body of work with the Department of Housing in relation to coastal erosion and the risks associated with that, not just in terms of infrastructure, but also in terms of houses, businesses, amenities that are literally falling into the sea every day of the week.
Okay.
And Donegal, with its enormous coastline, is a county that is a particular risk and a particular concern and a particular worry to us in the Office of Public Works.
I mean, obviously, you don't have a crystal ball, but some people might say, this is more, you know, more research, more planning. Like, when do you think we might actually see proper flood relief schemes across Donegal? I think there's 12 areas identified at the moment, but let's take Letterkenny and Donegal Town. Like, we're in a process, but when do you think we'll actually start seeing significant works in both of those areas?
So to answer your question, with my other hat on, is Aaron O'Gertick, to call Lua of the Sustainer as soon as we can. But we have to go through a planning process for which we're not the authors of. And we're also, like anybody that's applying to build a car park or a house or a business or anything, we are applicants to a planning process to which people, the public, non-governmental organisations, state bodies can all put in observations. It takes a long time. And even when you get planning permission, there's no guarantee you can proceed because sometimes there's appeals to other bodies. So I wouldn't care to put a time frame on it. However, what I will say is this. We are committed financially. There is no issue in relation to money. And there also is no issue now, which confirmed today, in relation to capacity within the council. The train is finally leaving the station with our approval. You know, this morning marks the commencement of two in Kilkenny, two in Donegal. And we're going to see how they get on over the next couple of months with the resources that we attach. I believe that it'll be successful because it's an initiative that I've been trying to progress. And thereafter, I'd like to see it advance and rolled out to the other counties around the country, the other 24 counties that have similar schemes in gestation at different levels across the country.
All right. Interesting to use a train metaphor in Donegal, but sure, we'll let you away with that. Thanks very much for your time.
No bother. Thanks very much.
Take care. All right. And quite interestingly, the Northwestern Flood Risk Management Plan 2018, in outlining a flood relief scheme for Letterkenny, it found that it would protect 51 properties from coastal flooding. And I wasn't probably should be aware, but I never really considered it before, that Letterkenny is apparently very susceptible to climate change, particularly sea level rising. As I say, it's not something that was ever in my mind, but I was surprised to read that. And over the coming years, because of climate change and rising sea levels, an additional 56 properties are at risk under future flood predictions. So that's going to form part of this scheme. Other flood relief schemes planned for Donegal, by the way, are Carndonagh, Dunfanaghy, Killybegs and Rathmullen, we're told, while the OPW is also exploring the viability of schemes at Bunbeg, Derrybeg, Convoy and Mobile. So we'll see if that happens in my lifetime. Right. Any views on that? 086 60 25,000. 086 60 25,000, or give us a call on 074 91 25,000. Reading today that the ongoing delay in setting up a vaccine damage compensation scheme for people who suffer severe reactions now looks set to be dragged out even further. While a working group headed by former National Maternity Hospital Master Dr. Rona Mahoney has been established to examine the issue, no separate unit within the Department of Health has yet been put in place to support the work. The holdup was revealed in a parliamentary question from independent TD Dennis Nocton, who has been pursuing the matter for many years. Mr. Nocton said commitments were given in the past two programmes for government to introduce a no-fault vaccine compensation scheme. This was again promised by the former Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, in advance of the introduction of the COVID vaccination programme. My engagement on this issue with various ministers for health has been ongoing, he says, for the past 250 months or more than two decades. How many children have to be dragged through the courts to get the expert support they need as a result of being damaged by a state-supported vaccination programme before we will see any action, he asked there. And, yep, certainly something that needs to be moved forward. Right, let's take a short break. Back in a moment. Now, Deputy Padraig McLaughlin has called on the Tánaiste to back up his positive words about reinstating the Derry to Dublin air link and the upgrade of the A5 with concrete action. Good morning to you, Deputy McLaughlin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Greg.
Before we talk about the air route, we were talking earlier on about a meeting taking place in Omagh next Saturday with a view to, getting public support to progress the A5. We know how badly it is needed for a number of reasons, primarily for safety reasons. What role, because, I mean, I've been doing this for a long time now, and I remember the A5 funding, government funding, it was every year and then it sort of slipped off the radar. Where are we at in terms of commitment to help funding this currently? And what do you think the Irish government might be able to do to progress it?
Well, if we go back to October 2006, we had the St Andrews Agreement. And at that time, as part of that agreement, the Irish government committed to co-fund the A5 upgrade. So we're going back, nearly 17 years. It was a co-funding commitment. Now, over the years, that has been watered down to like a 75 million euro commitment. And it just, it isn't good enough. But of course, the biggest problem with the A5 has been our hearts have been broken with the objections, the delays, the court cases, the studies, the consultation, again and again and again. So I am pleased to see now a very strong grassroots campaign based on road safety, not just our right to have the same roads infrastructure as everywhere else on the island of Ireland. And I'm hopeful that we can finally get this project over the line. And when that happens, the Irish government need to recommit to fully co-fund the project.
Yeah, of course. And you know, you recognised, and I said in the intro, the public safety is paramount, but also there's many other reasons in terms of access for business, education, whatever it might be. Perhaps something that could be delivered in a shorter amount of time is the Derry-Dublin Air Link. I didn't hear the Tánaiste's comments in relation to this. Give us the history of it. It used to be there, then it was lost. Was it availed of? Is there a business model for it to be returned? I presume, obviously, with subvention.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the City of Derry Airport, 40% of the passengers that use that airport every year are from Donegal. So what you have, I suppose, is in the eastern half of Donegal and the Shoghan, Finn Valley, going into Letterkenny, would use Derry Airport to access, I suppose it'd be flights to England, Scotland, and some European destinations. But the Derry to Dublin Air Link was in place about 12 years ago. It was a public service obligation funded by the Irish government, and it was removed. So we've been without it all of that time. Now, in recent times, the airport have been putting together reports. They've been engaging with the Department of Transport, with various ministers in Dublin. And I've read their reports, and there's no doubt of the immense economic benefit and the tourism benefit from reinstating the link. It's not just about, of course, flying from Derry to Dublin. It's about flying on from then, from Dublin to all these destinations around the world. So you're connecting tourists and businesses from all around the world into Dublin to connect onto Derry, and of course that connects you into Donegal, West Tyrone, the whole region. So it's really, really vital. So I was pleased to hear the Taoiseach Micheál Martin say finally, you know, that we need to reinstate that link. Now that he said that, we need to see action to match the words.
And I mean, it is, I think it's beholden to any government, be it in Belfast or Dublin for that matter, not to neglect a part of the country just because it's further away. In fact, it should be positively discriminated against. You should be sitting in Dublin, a decision maker should be, and say, my word, look at that gap in the Northwest. You know, we are responsible for all of this country. We should actually make sure that if someone gets off a plane in Dublin and they want to go to the Northwest, and of course the Donegal Airport is there, but, you know, that might actually be bringing people further away from their chosen destination. It's a non-brainer. We shouldn't have to compete and argue and lobby for basic access.
Yeah, and what makes me very angry is that, like, I'm a fan of the city of Derry Airport and the team that have run it now for many years. And, you know, recently they have had really good news in that the link to London is no longer to London Stansted, but it's to London Heathrow, which is one of the major airports in the world with huge connections around the world. So that's a real good news story for the Northwest. But it really is unacceptable that, you know, you've had Stormont and Derry City and Strabane District Council, the ratepayers of that council, have put huge money into the airport in the absence of Irish government funding, even though 40% of the passengers are from Donegal. So it's deeply unfair that the Irish government have not put any money into that airport now for over a decade. It is strategically very important to our region. And, you know, especially, you know, you get the map of Ireland out, and when you look at the map of Ireland, you look at the rail links, you look at the electricity infrastructure, you look at the motorways, you look at the air links, you know, in every capacity, rail, roads, air, you know, Donegal in the Northwest has been utterly neglected by both British and Irish governments. And now is the time, you know, I welcome the Taoiseach's words, but we need concrete action. There's surplus of money in our budget. There's a surplus of money in the Exchequer. They need shovel-ready projects. Derry City to Dublin Airlink could be done at a click of a finger within the next month if they wanted to, and it needs to happen.
Mm. A quick word with you. I know the only polls that matter are the ones on election day, but another set of polls out at the weekend, which shows, and I try and point it out in this programme, continued decent support for the government parties. But if you look at seat predictions, it seems difficult, and we're a long way out, Porrick, and sorry for drawing you into this, but sure, you can tell me to sod off if you like. But it seems that the way things are panning out, if Sinn Féin are to be next in government, and that's what everyone seems to be talking about, that you are going to have to coalesce with a Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, most likely the former. Do you be discussing that at this time? Because if you look at the numbers, it seems the only way realistically the numbers work.
Yeah, and you know, at the last election, you know, obviously afterwards, a lot of people said Sinn Féin, you didn't run enough candidates, and that was true. We didn't. We obviously looked at the 2019 local elections, which were disappointing for Sinn Féin across. Apart from Donegal, they were actually very good in Donegal, but down the country, very bad. And we were overly cautious. We won't make that mistake again. So our objective in the next election is to run as many candidates as we can, to elect as many Sinn Féin TDs as possible, and to be in the strongest possible position to form a government. I mean, our preference would be that you would not have Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in the next government. That would be our preference, but it's up to the people to decide. And when we look at the number of seats that are there, our desire is to lead the next government, to drive a Sinn Féin programme for government that's been won the support of the people, and to be as strong as possible to deliver the change that our people need. That's what we need to do.
Yeah, and I mean, we'll have tons of time to talk about this when any time an election is called, but could you see Sinn Féin in government with Fine Gael, or would you more likely see some sort of an alliance with Sinn Féin leading the government with Fianna Fáil? Either or?
Well, my preference, and it's the preference I know of all of the Sinn Féin leadership, is that we would not be in coalition with either of those parties. We think that they've had, you know, control of the state now for 100 years between them. They're now in government together. And you know, we feel to deliver change, it'd be best without them being there. So that's what our focus is. I mean, we haven't ruled out coalition with anybody because we're not arrogant enough to do that. Like, we have to focus on electing as many Sinn Féin TDs as possible to give people, no matter where they are in Ireland, the chance to elect as many as possible. And the more TDs we elect, the stronger our position. You know, I mean, it's estimated that we could elect between 60, 70, maybe 80 Sinn Féin TDs in the next election. So our focus is on electing as many as possible to be in as strong a position as possible. I mean, we look at housing and health, and these are two huge areas that need radical change, a whole radical new approach. And I think the more Sinn Féin TDs we elect, the stronger we are to do that.
And finally, has the strategy in Donegal been determined yet? Obviously, you know, three the last time was a bridge too far and maybe even backfired to some extent in terms of getting the two elected. Is the strategy, do you think, or can you say at this point, if it's going to be three, and if it is, which I'm sure it is, in terms of candidate selection, how's that process going?
Yeah, I mean, if Donegal remains a five-seater, and I think, by the way, it would be very, very unfair if Donegal remained a five-seater when the Commission completes its work in August of this year, then we will run three candidates. We haven't selected the third candidate yet, but we will run three candidates. And if Donegal becomes two three-seaters, which I think would be the fairest outcome for the people of Donegal, Donegal North East and Donegal South West reinstated, we would run two candidates in each constituency. So that's where we're at. And we obviously need to wait to see what the outcome of the commission is in August. And then after that, we will then move towards selecting the candidates required that our people need.
All right. Listen, thanks for all of that. I appreciate your time. That's Sinn Féin party whip and spokesperson on the Marine and Deputy Padraig McLaughlin. OK, back with more shortly. It's been mooted that the EU are looking to allow 16-year-olds onto the road driving cars with or vehicles with a limiter on them. Mary joins us now. Mary, familiar, of course, to listeners, on the road over half a century herself, also a road safety campaigner for the last 18 years. Mary, your initial reaction to this conversation?
Good morning, Greg. How are you? Thank you for having me on. I'll tell you my initial reaction, if you permit me to say a couple of things first, please. I want to extend my sincere condolences to the families of the people who had three family killed in County Tyrone. It was just a horrific accident. I did send in a text message to Highland at the time. So, I mean, my heart goes out to them. It was terrible. So, I'm a bit rusty because I haven't been on Highland for quite a while.
No, you're doing fine. Just relax, Mary. You're good.
My initial reaction was my stomach churned. I could feel the butterflies turn around in my stomach when I heard it mentioned that they were suggesting that 16-year-olds would be allowed on the road. Keys of a vehicle, a mechanically propelled vehicle, should never be given to 16-year-olds. Under any circumstances.
Why is it because of maturity, Mary? What worries you about it?
Oh yes, Greg. A number of things. 16-year-olds. Number one, their brains are not developed enough at 16 for to anticipate the hazards and the possibilities of accidents on the road. I mean, it's a known fact from experts, Greg, that. Now, before the daggers get out, you know that I started my campaign because of my love and concern for young people after horrific tragedies and in the show of young people. So, and I did it for 18 years, unaided and unfunded and unpaid. So it was love and respect and care for young people. I have the greatest respect for young people, unbelievable respect for young people. But you have to consider they're highly intelligent in school, way beyond our intelligence in school, but getting behind the wheel of a mechanically propelled vehicle in today, especially on today's roads, is a totally different scenario altogether. It's a known fact from experts that brains of especially boys are 3 years behind girls in the development of their brains.
Yes.
And apart from that, young people don't have the experience I know you say that if they don't get out on the road, where are they going to get the experience? But they need to wait to be given the keys of a vehicle until their brains are developed enough to be able to think ahead, mm-hmm. to be able to anticipate the dangers, to be able to think anticipate what might be around the next corner or the next bend. You know, do you know what I'm saying?
Plus, okay, but Mary, just for the purpose of conversation and not in any way to be objectional to you, because I respect you too much for that, but let us just say that, you know, you have the minimum 12 tests. So you have to do your theory test. So you have to understand the basic rules of the road. It's just a memory competition, really, that. But anyway, then you have your 12 tests, and then you have a test to see if you're competent enough to drive. You pass your driving test. So if someone can, because you know yourself, you can meet one 16 that's more mature than a 50-year-old, and you could meet a 50-year-old that's, you know, that drives like a 15-year-old might. So do you not trust the learning and testing process enough that only obviously competent 16-year-olds then might find themselves out on the roads?
You're quite right what you say, Greg, but all the education in the world and any aspect of life does not produce experience. And experience is the greatest factor in helping to prevent road collisions or road accidents. Like, when I was doing presentations, I mean, I've been all over Ireland doing presentations, 50 PowerPoint, 50 slides of PowerPoint slides, and I always have a question and answer session with the students afterwards. And almost everyone, when I would ask them, what do you think, in your opinion, what do you think that I have from driving that you don't have? And hands went up, and almost everyone would say experience.
Mm-hmm.
Experience is an important factor in driving. And a 16-year-old, Greg, there is no way that boys or girls has experience of the dangers that's on the roads at the present time. I mean, there's speed, there's alcohol, drugs, there's fatigue, there's not wearing seatbelts, there's a distraction of the mobile phone use. There's far too many distractions for 16-year-olds nowadays for to be out on the roads and the traffic, plus the fact the roads are in a desperate state at the present time.
Mm.
So, I mean, I could go on and on, Greg, but
it's a big no from you anyway. It's a no from Mary.
Mentioned about 16-year-olds, but I was, plus the fact, Greg, you mentioned the limiters. They can bypass the limiters.
Oh, of course. Yeah, they can. And as we heard from a professional driver earlier on, that he believes that you're talking about experience. He says it takes a lot of experience to be able to drive with a limiter on. He drives lorries and he has a lorry and coach license.
I know that scenario that lorry driver was talking about, actually.
Yes.
I know what he was referring to about the limiters.
Okay. Right, listen, thank you very much indeed. Mary, your concerns are noted. We do appreciate your time. Right, okay. Let's go to Tim Carey now, the head of the electoral operations with the Electoral Commission. Good morning to you, Tim. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you.
Just for those who aren't aware, outline the role of the electoral operations and electoral commission at the moment. Well, it's an ongoing role, but do you know what I mean?
It's an ongoing role, but a very newly established role. So we're a very new body. We were set up in February, and the commission will play a central role, really, in our democracy and our electoral system for the coming decades. We'll be responsible for referendum campaigns, registration of political parties, addressing the issues of misinformation and disinformation on social media, carrying out research, advising the government, making proposals to the Minister of Housing and the government on electoral matters. So it's a very wide brief under the commission. And the commission is chaired by Supreme Court Justice Mary Baker, and there's six other members on the commission. But our first task of the commission is to review constituency boundaries for the Dáil and European elections.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay, and I'm not going to be able to draw you into speculating as to what's going to happen here in Donegal, so I won't even try. But maybe you can help us, Tim. Maybe you can help us with the process, okay? Because obviously, I presume you're there are people making submissions and what have you. So when you look at a county, which at the moment Donegal is now, it's crazy what's going on. But anyway, I'm in Sligo for some reason, but I live in Donegal. And there is some speculation as to whether that'll be retained. The county could change altogether, split into two. I don't know. So what is the process for making the decision? What are the factors considered, perhaps, Tim's the best question?
Okay, so there's two parts to this, really. One is constitutional. So there are provisions in the Constitution that are very relevant to this. And, you know, some of your listeners will know about it, but I think many listeners won't be aware of this. One of these is that every TD must represent between 20 and 30,000 people on average throughout the country. The second provision, and this makes it even a bit more complicated or much more complicated, is that a TD in Donegal needs to represent the same amount of people, by and large, as close as can be, to a TD in Wexford. Okay, so this creates a very kind of complicated picture.
Well, is that not further hamstrung by the fact that you can have a maximum of 5 TDs in one constituency? Is that the case?
And it is, yeah. So the maximum of 5, and that is the case, and that has been laid out in legislation. So we have those two constitutional issues, and then we have legislative issues, of which one says that every constituency must be 3, 4, or 5 TDs. Okay, so that's set down in law, and that's been the case for decades. We've received a number of submissions, people saying, oh, I want my county to be a 6-seater. It's actually not possible for the Electoral Commission to do that because the law currently says that there must be 3, 4, and 5 seats.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other terms of reference, and again, Donegal will be a case in point, and many of your listeners, including yourself, would raise it, is that the Commission needs to respect county boundaries wherever possible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, given that it's 20 to 30,000 TDs, across the country, and equality of representation and 3, 4, or 5 seat constituencies, that is obviously not always going to be possible. It's inevitable the county boundaries will be breached.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Commission, in its deliberations, you know, will be seeking to fix problems as opposed to
how nuanced can that be, Tim? Because, listen, North Leitrim, right, mm-hmm. or South Roscommon or wherever, I get it, you know, half the county, it makes sense. But say, for instance, in Donegal, and this could, I'm not asking you to adjudicate on this because I know you can't and it wouldn't be fair, but a chip off Donegal was taken, right? Now, what I want to know is when you're considering this, do you consider the likely outcome of an election? Because if you live in Lahey, or part of Lahey, half of Lahey, or Ballyshannon, for an example, it's incredibly, incredibly likely that you are going to be represented by a Sligo-based TD from down, you know, Sligo town or even further south. So can you consider the likely outcome of election to sort of say, well, with the best will in the world from the TDs, by the way, they mentioned Donegal, I've got that, right? But in terms of, like, it's about to how fairly the people are represented. It's not just about the numbers and adding it up. Like, if the south of Donegal's a long way from where a TD's likely to be elected, you know, can you be that nuanced in the consideration? Because I think really that's where the problems occur, not just in Donegal, but maybe in other parts of the country.
Yeah, look, there are issues in various parts of the country that are kind of historic or have come from previous constituencies. Because of the constitutional issues, it's the constitutional issues which take precedence in terms of, you know, we must... You know, or else the whole thing is opened up to challenge.
Yeah, I get you. You'd just be trying to fix holes everywhere.
And the Commission is trying to, you know, look at those issues of, you know, representation and, you know, appreciating the fact that, you know, people like to be within their own counties for very valid reasons. But it's those constitutional issues which take primacy, and then the other matters fall out from that. So it's not easy. Like, it isn't easy. And there's not sometimes a perfect solution.
Of course. Now, we don't necessarily have to consider the constitutional implications of the situation in making our submissions. You know, if I have if I think this should be the case, I can make a submission by May the 10th. And then, of course, it's up to you guys to see how all of that can be squeezed into those constitutional restraints that you talk of. So public submissions are now open and are being accepted. So how do people do that, and what form might it take, Tim?
Okay, so our website, electoralcommission.ie, if you go onto that, it's very clear how you can make your submission. And the information that I've just sort of given you an introduction to is all written there in black and white.
Brilliant.
So you can very fully appreciate the issues that there are. Because we're conscious that people aren't really aware of these issues. Mm. And what I would say is, you know, people can absolutely send their views on their own constituency, regardless of reasoning that was previously given as to why it is the way it is. But also feel free to send your views on the overall process, on the constitutional provisions, on the legislative provisions, because the Electoral Commission is a permanent body now, and it will be doing these reviews every census, so every 5 years, forever, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it's important for the Commission to learn and to consider people's views as we come to future constituency reviews. So, you know, let us know your thoughts.
Okay, and very finally and very briefly, Tim, and this is our fault, not yours, obviously, which population figure do you use? Because, say, for instance, in Donegal, our population has increased really quite significantly, not all reflected in the last census. So what metric do you use?
We use the official census figure.
Okay.
So
right.
we have the draft ones at the moment. The final ones are being published on May the 30th. So they will be our figures. And just so you're aware, like, the Irish population is increasing by 2 TDs every year on average at the moment.
Okay.
So we're going to see the largest increase in the number of TDs for decades. And that's going to be announced. It's going to be a minimum increase of 11 TDs and possibly up to 21 new TDs will be recommended by the constituency review.
Isn't that just fantastic, Tim? Thank you very much indeed. Have a lovely day. Tim Carey, who's head of electoral operations with Electoral Commission. Okay, back with you tomorrow morning at 9. Have a lovely day. Stay tuned. John Breslin's next.